Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, and this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of October 8th. I'm joined this week by Jim Keane, Jesuit Scholastic on the staff here at America. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're going to try something new this week. We're going to do a discussion about a contemporary novel. This is an occasional feature we'll have on the podcast. We'll invite folks in to discuss either novels or contemporary nonfiction. This week's selection is Andrew O'Hagan's Be Near Me, which was just published last month. Maybe, Jim, you can give us a little plot summary of the book.
Well, without giving away too much of the story, Father David is a priest having recently moved to Scotland, who has worked for much of his life in England, and he's in a parish where he's not particularly well-liked, and he has sort of an aesthetic approach to the priesthood. He spends a lot of time alone or with his housekeeper, and he doesn't seem to have a lot of friends, but he does become close with sort of some unexpected characters, and a lot of the plot revolves around not only his friendship with them, but the sense in which the townspeople both accept and reject him, with some startling turns in plot resulting from that.
And I'll give you a little bio of Andrew O'Hagan, who's the novelist. He's a young novelist, British, in his late 30s, has written a lot for the New York Review of Books and also the London Review of Books. And he wrote in The Guardian about the genesis of this novel. He was actually in Paris and was in a restaurant there and noticed across the room a priest who was having dinner alone, and at what point he noticed a tear on the priest's cheek. And this got him thinking about, you know, why is this priest so sorrowful, etc. We were going to read an excerpt just to give you a flavor of his writing to start with. So, Jim, will you do that for us?
Sure. Thank you, Tim. This is from fairly early on in the book when Father David is talking about his father. We come from a long line of Catholics. It still feels vaguely presumptuous to speak of our ancestors. I think of them as my father's people, the Andertons, those Lancashire monks and martyrs whom my father admired less for their undying faith than for the commanding way they had tried to take hold of life. He would speak of John Rigby, son of Margaret Rigney, née Anderton, who was hanged, drawn, and quartered in London in the year 1600 for refusing to join the state church. He was better than a saint, my father said. He knew the things he had to do. Then there was Thomas Anderton, prior of St. Edmund's in Paris, who wrote the History of the Iconoclasts. These people had learning, my father would say. They weren't afraid to get up in the morning. Their names were everywhere in my childhood. They fell like unsettled dust from the roof beams and attics of ancient memory. There was Lawrence Anderton, who wrote the Protestant's Apology under the pseudonym John Brerley. Then there was Robert Anderton, a student at Brasenose College, who acknowledged Elizabeth I, but said he would not oppose the Pope, and was later executed for his trouble on the Isle of Wight. The Anderton name is often to be found on the recusancy rolls, and when I was 5 or 6, my father would sometimes take me by the hand to the graveyards of Writington, Inspundell, or Hindley. I can still see dragonflies hovering over the grass and darting between the stones. One of my last memories of my father is on such a day, at a graveyard outside Wigan. You see, he said, bending down at a grave and scraping the stone with his fingernail. Anderton, cotton mill worker, it says. Not the one that got executed in London. I remember him making a friendly frown, and his blue surgeon's eyes swallowing me and the graveyard, its trees and its toadstools, too. I can see him so clearly, with his good hair and the pale sun at his back. My father reaching out from my wrist and squeezing, it seems now, for all the years that he wouldn't know me. We didn't die only for God, he said.
Well, thanks, Jim. I think that gives a good sense of, first of all, O'Hagan's writing style, which is quite beautiful at times, and also the story of this character, Father David, who comes from this long line of Catholic martyrs and chooses the priesthood himself. But let's start with Father David, who is the narrator of the book, and at one point Father David says of his father, who you just mentioned, every small element of life fascinated him and he wanted to get it right. And this could be said of Father David as well. You know, he was, as you said, you know, very sophisticated in his choices of wine or food. And
yeah, you know, one of the things that O'Hagan has said in other interviews is that he really opposes the idea that in a novel a character has to be sympathetic in some ways, that you have to identify with them. And he would prefer characters who actually can be sort of distasteful in a way. Father David is a good example of that, is that on the one hand, he's someone you feel sympathy for because he seems like kind of a lonely figure and he seems to be kind of classy in a way, but But on the other hand, he does seem to have taken up this sort of aesthetic ideal of the bachelor's life, the good food, the right cheese, the right wine, the good vacations, reading the right book and listening to the right music. And I think it's an element of the priesthood that is a danger that you do see in real life with priests sometimes, is a certain willingness to turn towards an aesthetic appreciation of the life of an unmarried man as opposed to the actual sacrifices and daily life of a priest.
Yes, and I don't want to give the plot away, but there is a reason that he chooses the priesthood. There's a traumatic event in his life that leads to this decision. For me, it seemed like he was almost backing into the priesthood. It wasn't, you know, something that he embraced wholeheartedly. It was something that he felt that was a good choice for him, given, you know, that he had few other alternatives.
Right, and I think there's also, the way this is done is he essentially, because of where he goes to school and some of the people he knows, there's certainly elements here that reflect sort of the Brideshead Revisited culture that you see throughout the book of young men who, through aesthetic reasons or through sort of the unexpected events of their lives, are called to conversion. And in his case, he's called, he gets a vocation to the priesthood. And I think that's part of it. I think there's something else that's going on as well. O'Hagan has kind of a clever take on the symposium where Socrates is arguing with his interlocutors, and they come to the conclusion that real truth and real beauty are only realized through, at the beginning, an appreciation of physical beauty in another person. And then you slowly go up through the ladder of understanding until you reach the true forms of beauty and truth. And in some ways, I think O'Hagan is trying to get at that, is that this character really understands his relationship with the divine through the baby steps of the beauty of another person.
Now, what did you think of the Catholic stuff in the book? I don't know if O'Hagan himself is Catholic, but he did not, for example, go to Ampleforth, which is where Father David went, which is a famous Catholic boarding school. It felt right to me. Did it feel right to you?
It did. I think one element that could seem a little strange is sort of the hostility of the townspeople, the fact that they weren't very open. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is that this is a Scottish church. So these are descendants of Irish and Celtic people who are in Scotland, essentially in an anti-Catholic land in a lot of ways, maybe not so much anymore, but certainly back then. And so I don't think we can fully understand the class issues and the ethnic issues that go into that. For example, Father David is depicted as having sort of a posh accent, like he was English, and that is recognized by the local people as being a sign of maybe putting on airs or being a Protestant or being from London, something like that. But there's also a sense in which the life of the parish is captured. There are these sort of tropes of parish life that are certainly there in terms of the rituals, in terms of the regular nature of the seasons and the duties of a priest living alone in kind of a far-flung parish that I did think felt right.
One of the interesting choices he makes as a novelist, he begins it on Good Friday. Father David has just done the Good Friday service, and he's at home with his housekeeper, Mrs. Poole. He's looking for something nice for lunch, and Mrs. Poole is sort of berating him good-heartedly of saying, you know, this is Good Friday. You shouldn't be eating. You should be fasting, you know, and shouldn't be drinking wine. But over the course of the book, you realize that that's who Father David is. He's really not a Good Friday Catholic. You know, he doesn't like that part of the faith, the part that deals with, you know, the darkness or sorrow. He's very much, you know, an Easter Sunday Catholic.
Yes, it's true, and there's a way in which O'Hagan really depicts some of Father David's moments that he should have suffered in life when he experienced loss without really engaging those emotions directly. More often you see descriptions of, say, Father David's trips with his mother to a beautiful place or a nice trip, and he does seem to skirt the issue of suffering a little bit a lot. He tends much more to look for the joyous and the more pleasing to the senses in his life.
Well, in the book, you mentioned earlier in your plot summary that he encounters a group of unlikely friends that he makes, and the beginning of it is on Good Friday. And in recounting his meeting of these two young people who go to the school that's affiliated with his church, he says that that's when he first got the sense of the Easter joy was in their presence, which is a strange, it's hard to understand for us, but it gives you a sense of who he is.
Certainly, and I think what you have there also is a capturing of one's youth, which is an idea of rebirth, which is certainly an Easter notion, not a Good Friday one, at least in this book.
Well, we just want to read another excerpt where it gives you a little flavor of O'Hagan's picture of parish life. And this is a funny episode involving Father David and Mr. Dorn, who's the music teacher. Do you want to read this, Jim?
Sure. Let me give it a stab. I bumped into Mr. Doran at the edge of the sports wing. Doran was head of music and very short. I was wearing needlessly ugly ties over his junior shirts. Not for the first time, I wondered if he had become a teacher in order to feel like one of the world's naturally tall people. He certainly swaggered among the pupils as if his chance to be big had finally come. I also noticed he had the beginnings of a mustache. "Ah, just a man," I said, placing the crucifix and some other things on the register table. "Hello, Father David," he said, trying to dodge me with an armful of violins. "I'm awfully busy. This was supposed to be a day off." "Of course," I said. "Just a word in your small ear." I see now in many ways that I was not wise. Doran smarted. "If it's about the music, you must spare me." "Not a bit of it, Mr. Doran," I said. "I made a request of you at the beginning of Lent. Let us not have any more of these rubbishy hymns. There is no one else to whom I can address these remarks. You are the man in charge. Rubbishy hymns, horrible words. What are these hymns about sunny days and being happy? Where do they come from? In the new term, can we not progress a little to some proper music?" "Excuse me, Father," he said. "These hymns have been used in Scottish schools for quite some time. They're very popular. The pupils like to sing them." "They also like to sing M&M, Mr. Doran, and we shan't be introducing that to the Mass just yet. I gave you the music. I didn't hear any of it at the Mass for the beginning of the Easter holiday. Could you not manage Cross of Jesus? It being Easter, Cross of Jesus?" "I don't know it." "Music by John Stainer, 1841 to 1901, I said. "Words by William Sparrow Simpson, 1860-1952. I squeezed some sheet music between his instruments. "Please don't do that, Father. I won't be patronized in this way every time I see you." "Mr. Doran, I'm not asking for the Stabat Mater." "Yes, you are," he said. "In the context, yes, you are."
Thanks, Jim. Well, I think that I enjoyed that little give and take between the music teacher and the priest, which is something that I think often happens in a parish, the struggles between the folks running the music ministry and the pastor.
Certainly, especially when you have the difference between someone who is attached to older hymns, maybe not so much for their content, but for the memories they inspire. Certainly, Father David, throughout the rest of the book, is not someone who wants to hear Cross of Jesus.
Now we're going to talk about some of the other characters in the book, and one of them is Mrs. Poole, who is his housekeeper, who I referenced earlier. Now, Mrs. Poole is probably in her early 40s and is a resident of this town that Father David has come to, has been assigned to. And she is unlike the other people in town in that she has her own interests and ambitions. She's learning French. She enjoys French cooking. She gardens. So she has a certain sophistication that a lot of the other townspeople do not. And she likes being with Father David because she likes being in his company. It makes her feel more sophisticated. It makes her feel like she's a little different from everyone else. What did you think of her as a character?
Oh, I really liked her for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's a long tradition in books about priests, whether that be J.F. Powers or Mauriac or Bernanos, of these characters of the housekeeper. Certainly in J.F. Powers, in his stories, there's always a housekeeper who either grounds the priest or plays kind of a grotesque character or is sort of a stand-in for a wife or a mother. Also, in the United Kingdom, there's a long tradition of shows and books that sort of poke fun at the local vicar and the other character, the sort of straight man or the comic foil, is often the housekeeper. So Father Ted, all these various Anglican novels about the silly vicar riding around on his bicycle. And so there's a long tradition there, and Mrs. Poole sort of fits into that tradition because from the outside she seems very gray and drab and stern, but then when she gets into the house, she knows the music, she's speaking French, she's preparing these special lettuce soup for Father David, and she really has found in him some kinship that she can't find with her husband, who's sort of the local lower class town drunk. She really uses, in that sense, Father David. She both gets some comfort from him, but also is a real goad to him to act like a real priest. There's a wonderful moment where she tells him he's trying to joke around with her, and she says to him, "Your job as a priest is not to make things smaller than they are. It's to prepare people for the big decisions in life. Your job is not to make everything a joke." And putting him in his place, that it's not just a friendship that involves a lot of wordplay and laughter, but that he is, in a sense, a minister that he sometimes forgets.
Yeah, and their relationship really does reveal the fact that he doesn't, he sort of shies away from, as we talked about before, these Good Friday elements of the faith that, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but she has her own issues that she deals with and some health issues. And over time, she is really seeking his counsel, and she wants him to act as a priest to her. But he pulls away a little bit, although he does offer some financial help. The spiritual help she seeks, it's harder for him to provide that.
Right, and it's almost like, in a sense, he would rather the two of them garden together than he have to give her any spiritual counsel.
Right, right. Now, the other character who's quite interesting is David's mother, who is quite eccentric. David's father passed away when he was young, and he was taken care of by his mother, who became a romance writer. Is that what or historical novels?
I think she did. She wrote sort of racy historical novels.
Yeah, like bodice rippers, I guess, and
yes,
those sorts of things. She is obviously has some money and has enabled David to live the lifestyle that he might not otherwise have been able to as a priest. You know, she buys all the nice wine and such for him. And when David goes through a difficult moment, I don't want to reveal it here, but she is the first one to take him in. So she's very open to him, but in some ways she seems a little oblivious to exactly what he's going through.
Yes, and I think that there's a couple things going on there, too. One is the long tradition in Anglo-American literature of the mama's boy priest or the mama's boy minister. And so the mother figure would often play a big role, either for comic effect or just as an expression of the reality of a celibate lifestyle. And so I think in that sense, O'Hagan is trying to capture that relationship. And I think he does that more or less successfully. She does seem a little technicolor to me in some respects. She seems a little too accepting too. She doesn't challenge him the way Mrs. Poole does in the book. But I also think there's a sense in which the basic theme of the book in some ways is how do you reach a sort of emotional intimacy with a person and how difficult that can be in certain circumstances. The mother in this book plays the one character that Father David never has to try with. They're always on an emotional level together. They're always connected in that sense.
Yeah, it's quite touching, some of the scenes between them, but she does come across as almost like a Mary Poppins character sometimes. She just indulges
exactly.
him, you know, and there's a scene where when he was in, I guess he was at, maybe he was at Ampleforth, and he arranged a big elephant to come to town, and she's the one who bought it because she thought it was just a wonderful idea. No matter how much it might cost, it was just a wonderful idea.
Exactly.
So. Another issue that, you know, a little sensitive is in the book, it's revealed that David is gay. Is that a cliche now to talk about that in a novel like this?
Well, I think O'Hagan does a good job of portraying the struggles of someone who is gay without making him either out to be a martyr, because certainly he's not a martyr in any sense in this book, or making him out to be sort of God's greatest gift to creation just because he's gay. It's in some ways incidental to his priesthood that he is, and then in some ways it's very tied up in his vocation that he is. And that's a subtlety, I think, that has been missed in the sort of news coverage over the last couple of years of gay priests, is the subtleties that go into that, what ways in which it's very closely tied into their life as priests, and in what ways it has nothing to do with it. It's sort of an incidental, sort of like the color of one's hair in certain circumstances.
Right.
So I think that's done with some subtlety. I mean, it does complicate the relationships, because as a reader, I think readers are sensitive to that issue because it has been a big one in the church. So a Catholic reader is going to be sensitive to the fact that early on your antennae kind of pick up the fact that Father David is gay, and that colors your perception of the book a little bit. So, I mean, as a thematic strategy, it's risky for O'Hagan, but I think he does handle it fairly subtly.
Now, there's a center, the moment that the book revolves around involves, I can say, a kiss, but I won't say any more than that. And we won't give away what happens, but it is something that is inappropriate, though, you know, it's ambiguous in the book whether it is technically criminal. This is a familiar story that we've heard about a lot in recent years involving priests, and it's very delicate. O'Hagan, as a novelist, is obviously interested in looking at this familiar story from the other side. He talks about, in this interview we referenced earlier, about how he had seen in the news all of these, you know, vans, et cetera, news vans, and around a priest's house who had been accused of misconduct. And he said it was almost like a carnival atmosphere. And then he saw up in the window just like the curtain twitch, and it suddenly occurred to him, oh, there's a person up there, and what is that person going through?
Exactly. And I think that a lot of the development of this scene and in the book in general is trying to portray something from the perspective of a person who's accused of criminal wrongdoing without necessarily delivering any sort of justification for it or making it a manifesto. And I think O'Hagan is trying to show, once again, as I said earlier, a person who isn't doesn't have to be a sympathetic hero. That the protagonist of a novel can be someone who is much more complicated than that, and in some ways more, you know, much more distasteful than we would prefer. But that there are always a series of concrete events that lead one to a specific decision or a specific action, and those events in themselves can be either innocent or they can be very complicated things that don't have a single cause. That was interesting. In the novel, you feel yourself sort of building towards this, a certain point where something catastrophic is going to happen. And there is a sense of wanting to pull back, no, you know, let's not let this get to this point, let's not go to this stage. That I think is well plotted out by O'Hagan.
Finally, I think we're going to talk a little bit about what other books this reminded you of. There's a scene in the middle of the book where O'Hagan talks about Father David's his college days at Oxford, and where he was part of two different groups. One was the Marcellists, who were fans of Proust and were constantly quoting right. from, you know, Swan's Way, and then the others were the Bombastics. Was that it?
I think so. Yes. Yeah,
and those were the folks who were, you know, in the '60s and very much, you know, taking part in protest rallies. And the scenes, at least among the Marcellists, do have a Bride's Head flavor to them. And at one point, they even say, somebody references a character in Bride's Head, and David says, well, that's too much. You know, although they are kind of consciously trying to live that life, to mention it, they said, well, that's a fantasy, that life. Although that's, you know, in a way, when you read these scenes, you can't help but think of Bride's Head.
Right, right. And I mean, the scenes of him as a young man, either studying at Oxford or studying in Rome for the priesthood, the way those are depicted, I mean, it might as well be strawberries and champagne under a tree. Very much, there's a lot of echoes of Bride's Head. Now, on the American side of the Atlantic, I think there were two people who came to mind when I was reading it. One is obviously, as I mentioned earlier, J.F. Powers, just because the story written from the perspective of the priest and some of the tropes that come in there is very much J.F. Powers. When J.F. Powers died, one of his reviewers, I think it was John Derbyshire, said that in many ways, Powers is always called the typical American Catholic writer, but there's a sense in which you could say he wasn't religious at all in his writing. And Derbyshire's reasoning is that Powers' characters are never spiritual people. They're never, they never have great profound insights. They're oftentimes, they seem sort of not spiritual at all. And that is very true of Father David. He doesn't have, he doesn't seem to have a deep spiritual life, or if he does, it's kind of ignored in the book as incidental. The other person I thought of was John Irving. In books like The World According to Garp or The 158-Pound Marriage, you have these awful events that occur because a character made one wrong choice, then a second wrong choice, and then his or her counterpart made one wrong choice and a second wrong choice, and then the sort of awful facts of the universe intervene and something terrible happens, and much of the book is how you recover from that terrible event that itself had no cause or no blame, but was brought about, it was possible for it to happen because of these other things that happened. And that was very much here in that sense. And so Irving, while a very different writer than O'Hagan, is someone who I think I was reminded of throughout the book.
And one final thing I want to discuss is the language that O'Hagan uses. Now, you mentioned this when we first discussed the book off the air, was when you first start reading it, you're trying to figure out when does this book take place, because some of the language that he writes, especially when talking about David and his youth, is very, as we said, evocative of an earlier era. You know, it does remind you of Bride's Head. This could have taken place right. in the 20s or 30s. But then suddenly you're thrown into a situation in this, you know, backwater town in Scotland where you have young people talking, you know, like American rappers.
Right, exactly.
Now, I'm going to read quickly from a passage about that language. The lagered boys seemed unsure what to do at the wedding. Each just stood around in his shiny black shoes. Their way of talking kept jolting me back to another time. They spoke like redneck Yankee soldiers from the 60s or film mobsters. Or was it black people they'd never met except on music videos? One last thing. The book begins with an encounter between Father David and his mother, in which she says to him, "Always trust a stranger. In this life, it's the people you know who always let you down." Now, on one hand, this gives us some insight into the character of his mother, who is kind of contrarian in that way. But what else did you make of that quote?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, one is tempted to read into it a sort of Christological hint, is that in many ways it's like the Gospels, is that you have the disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they've been let down by everyone they know, and all of a sudden the stranger comes along who turns out to be the risen Christ. Mm. He's the only one they can trust. And, you know, the risen Christ is someone who, you know, a week earlier had been betrayed by his closest friends. The other sense is a much more pedestrian one, which is a little bit of a sad note, is that the character, David, he doesn't really have any choice but to trust strangers. And his downfall comes about because he does trust strangers, but it's because he doesn't really seem to have any friends. So he trusts young children, he trusts his housekeeper, he trusts the various people he meets in his day-to-day life, but he doesn't have anyone that he can really confide in the sense that he doesn't seem to be friends with the other priests. He doesn't seem to have stayed in touch with other people from his youth. And so in some ways he's forced into the position of trusting strangers because the people he knows are people who couldn't let him down because he doesn't have that close of a relationship with them.
Well, we'll end on that note. And Jim Keane, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
For what will hopefully be just the first installment of a regular feature here on the podcast where we'll be discussing current books. And as I've said before, Jim Keane teaches up at Fordham University a class on contemporary Catholic literature. So maybe we'll talk about one of those books.
Sure, that'd be great.
Great. Well, this is Tim Reedy for the American Magazine Podcast.